From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. This week, we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. I'm Gene Robinson, sitting in for your host, Welton Gaddy. Welton is a friend and colleague, and it is such an honor to sit in his seat. And my thoughts and prayers, as I'm sure yours are, with him and his family as they continue to grieve the loss of his son after a long illness. And please know that Welton will be back with us next week. On the interfaith calendar, this Tuesday is the Jewish observance of Tisha B'Av, a day of fasting in remembrance of the destruction of the temple, and Wednesday marks the Orthodox Christian Feast of the Transfiguration. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors are flooding across our southern border, primarily from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, at an estimated 90,000 this year.
Barack Obama is intentionally using the immigration crisis as an excuse to change the demographics and ultimately the electorate of this nation.
If you don't enforce these laws, people around the world are going to interpret it to mean that they should try to come illegally.
President Obama is trying to bring all of those illegal aliens to the country.
This is a man-caused disaster, and the man that caused it is Barack Obama.
Speed up the deportation of thousands of children who have poured over the border.
Compared to 150,000 that invaded France on D-Day.
53% of Americans believe that Americans do not have a moral obligation to offer asylum to people who come to the U.S. to escape violence or political persecution in their home country.
A rape path all the way through Mexico, and it's a death path on the death train.
The Senate failed to advance the $3.5 billion in emergency spending.
House Republicans canceling a vote on their own border funding bill.
So you're saying that the United States has an obligation,
yes.
Anyone who's suffering around the world has a right to come here and be supported
and break,
by you and me.
Break the law.
Hey, have you ever been to the Statue of Liberty?
Today we're going to take an up-close look at the moral, ethical, and humanitarian aspects of the situation on the United States-Mexico border, where the last 2 years have seen the arrival of some 50,000 unaccompanied minors, mostly from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. First, we'll examine the situation in these countries, which leads many parents to make the excruciating decision to send their children northward to the United States. I myself have just returned from 10 days in El Salvador, where I witnessed the culture of violence, brutality, and death which plagues that small nation, where two gangs rule the streets and lives of the people, with a government that is impotent to stop the violence, and where life is so dangerous for these kids that the perilous journey north is preferable to staying home. We'll talk with Richard Weinberg from the National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C., who was on that trip to El Salvador, about what he witnessed there at the front end of the human pipeline north. Next, we'll talk with Sherita Gruberg, who works in the area of immigration at the Center for American Progress, also in Washington, about her visit last week to one of the detention centers on the border where these children are being processed and then usually deported back to the violent situation from which they came. Her disturbing eyewitness view of what is happening at the Artesia Detention Center in New Mexico is a wake-up call to all Americans about what is being done in our names with these most vulnerable victims and refugees from violence. We will also look at an important 2008 anti-sex trafficking law meant to give a formal hearing to children arriving on our borders to determine if indeed they are victims of sex trafficking. Misguided Republicans in Congress now seem ready to sacrifice that law, which passed in an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote 6 years ago, in order to more quickly deport them back to their home countries without those hearings. You'll hear about how high the stakes are for some of the most vulnerable people in the world from Malika Sarr, executive director of the organization Rights for Girls. Finally, we will speak with Dr. Robert P. Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute about what Americans believe about this situation and what they believe should be done to respond in a humanitarian and compassionate way. Public opinion, of course, is divided on this issue, but we will see that the majority of Americans want us to treat these children as the refugees from violence that they are, young children fleeing from a desperately dangerous situation at home, and not simply coming to the United States for whatever economic benefits and a better life they might imagine here. Let me be clear from the outset. I come at this problem with a particular viewpoint about this situation. My own experience in El Salvador leads me to believe that I, as a parent, would also make a similar decision to send my children north to America if my family was faced with such daily violence and danger. And as a Christian and a student of both the Hebrew scriptures of the Old Testament and the Christian scriptures of the New, it is clear to me that one of the foundations of what God asks of God's people is the commandment to welcome the stranger. In Old Testament times, life often depended upon the hospitality of strangers. Over and over, the Hebrew people are told by their leaders and prophets to remember that they were once sojourners in a strange and hostile land, and that that remembrance should make them compassionate and welcoming to the stranger at their own gates. Jesus' own life begins with his being a refugee, along with his parents, fleeing to escape King Herod's murderous attack on children in an effort to kill the future Messiah, a threat to his own power. In his teaching, Jesus constantly reminded his hearers that they too are to be hospitable and compassionate to the most vulnerable in their midst. It seems to me that this is the lens with which people of faith must view the current situation at our borders, the exact opposite of the crass politicization that we have been witnessing in recent months and years. So let's begin with an eyewitness account of what is happening in one of these three countries that makes it easier to understand what is moving desperate parents to send their children on the perilous journey north to America. Joining me now is Richard Weinberg, Associate Director of Programs at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Recently, Richard and I were part of a small group of people organized by the National Cathedral that traveled to El Salvador as part of the Foundation Cristosal's Global School. Richard, I'm so happy to have you here to tell your story and my story here on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, Bishop Robinson.
Describe for us what you saw life was like in El Salvador for everyday people.
El Salvador continues to be a country that's marked by extreme poverty, and there's a stark class difference between the rich and poor, of course. You really can't talk about El Salvador without talking about its long civil war, which took the lives of 75,000 people and displaced countless more. And then, of course, following the war, violence has continued to be perpetrated by these rival gangs in the country. And despite an alleged truce, the violence is still continuing, really, between these gangs. They kind of truce to agree not to fight with each other anymore, but it doesn't mean that they're not doing all the same kind of organized crime that they were doing before and still resulting in the deaths of innocent people on the streets. Economically speaking, access to work is really scarce. The combined unemployment and underemployment rate is close to half of the population.
As you went to El Salvador and you knew the kind of political wrangling that's going on around the children at our border, what were you feeling? Could you better understand why a parent would make this really difficult decision to send their children north?
I absolutely could get a sense from the people that life is hard, and you really can't go to the authorities because, unfortunately, still the government is known to be rather corrupt. And during the war, there was this sense that you can't go to the government for help because, of course, during the war, it was the government-backed army that was fighting with the guerrillas. So there's this culture in El Salvador that we really just have to look out for ourselves, and I'm not going to trust authorities and go to them when there's violence because the violence could occur to me in retaliation.
So this new phenomenon of the country virtually being ruled by gangs is overlaid on top of decades of violence there and just intensifies it.
That's exactly right. The violence is really real. I know perhaps here in the States we wonder sometimes, is this all just about economic opportunity? And there's been a lot of debate about whether these children should be considered refugees versus just illegal immigrants. But the violence is very real. And here's a specific example. During our trip, we heard firsthand from staff at Cristosal about a woman that they're actively helping seek asylum here in the States. Her 13-year-old daughter was murdered by gangs, and she lives in a neighborhood just northwest of San Salvador, the capital. And she has told the staff at the foundation that if she goes to the authorities, she could lose her life in retaliation from the gangs. And she has two other sons to worry about. And they could threaten the lives of her sons if she goes to the authorities.
As one of the focuses of our trip, we were there to work with gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Salvadorans and some fledgling organizations that are trying to change things. What is life like there for them, and are they caught up in all this violence as well?
I would say about the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community in El Salvador that life is very difficult, and I think it's hard for us as North Americans to grapple with that when we live in a country with immense privilege and things as crazy as marriage equality being attained. And despite some progress, life really does continue to be quite a challenge for the LGBT community. UC Berkeley School of Law did this report back in 2012. That was a very comprehensive survey of the LGBT community, and it found that hate crimes toward LGBT people done by individuals, the gangs themselves, and even the police, there is a tragic number of murders happening to transgender women, and the cases simply go uninvestigated because they're trans women. Why should we care about their deaths? It's life or death for the LGBT community.
So life can be terribly grim for those people under those circumstances, and yet the journey north to America can be grim as well. Lots of sexual assaults are reported. Sometimes the paid smugglers will stop midway through Mexico and demand more money or else abandon the children and adults that they're with. What was your sense of the people of El Salvador? How much do they know about what's happening at our border, and is it on their minds?
We discovered that it was very much on their minds. These are people who pay attention to what's going on in the world. They pay attention to American politics. They have access to news just like we do. And they're very well informed, and they see our fellow Americans at the border who have sent quite an unwelcoming message to these children and to undocumented immigrants. And they see that, and they notice that. And I think oftentimes as those of us who are North Americans who are privileged enough to see other places in the world, we carry around the burden of being equated with people who are in the news and these kind of extreme sides of either liberal or conservative. But about the smugglers that you mentioned, you know, our mutual friend Noah Bullock, who's the executive director of Foundation Cristosal, he always talks about how these smugglers have such a bad reputation. But when you really understand, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the violence facing these communities and these people, you can really begin to understand why parents would make the agonizing decision to place their hope in these smugglers to get them to the U.S. I'd say that no parent wants to be separated from her child. As North Americans, this is hard for us to accept, I think, and we go there first, and maybe we criticize, and our minds are limited to understand how I could possibly put my son's life in the hands of these smugglers. But I don't believe that the Salvadoran parents who make the decision to send their kids across love their children any less than our North American parents love their children. That's true for El Salvador. It's true for a Honduran father. It's true for a Guatemalan mother.
So, Richard, next week you're leaving your work at the National Cathedral to begin your studies at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. What does your faith tell you that we should be doing for these children at our borders?
Bishop Robinson, you'll know I was a good Episcopalian, and I went to noon mass yesterday at All Souls in Woodley Park here in Washington. And the gospel appointed for the service was from St. Mark. It's the passage in which Jesus tells his disciples that we must welcome the little children as we would welcome Jesus. But Jesus also ends with this little quip: if any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. So I'm not saying that we should hang millstones around Congress's neck, although sometimes I think we do want to throw some of them into the sea. But what I am saying from our Christian standpoint, Jesus is calling us to care for the disenfranchised and specifically to welcome the little children as we would welcome him. I may not be a policy expert, but as a disciple of Jesus Christ, my faith tells me pretty clearly and unequivocally that we in the U.S. are called to do all we can to help these children.
Well, all I can say is amen to that. Richard Weinberg has been with the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. for nearly 8 years. Most recently, he's held the title of Associate Director of Programs. Richard, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for a wonderful trip to El Salvador. You will be in our prayers as you follow your vocation at the Candler School of Theology. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Bishop Robinson. Pleasure.
We've all seen the headlines. A surge of unaccompanied minors, primarily from Central America, has been overwhelming the systems we count on to provide both national security and a humanitarian response to genuine crises. The trap that we fall into, all too often, could be called the fog of data, when numbers tell us the facts, but not the reality of a given situation. And when policy and public debate happen at only the numbers level, a crucial part of the story is inevitably missing. That's why I'm grateful to be joined now by Sherita Gruberg, policy analyst at the Center for American Progress here in Washington, D.C., who's just back from a trip to the Artesia Detention Center in New Mexico. Sherita, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Would you start by talking about who you found in the detention center at Artesia?
When we visited, they were holding around 600 women and children, mostly children. The average age at this facility is 6 years old. And we weren't permitted to talk to a lot of people, but we did get to interview about 10 women who were being held. And the stories were really similar. About a third of the people there are from El Salvador, a third from Honduras, and a third from Guatemala. And there were just a lot of really, really frightened women who took their kids and fled the horrific violence that they were seeing. A lot of the violence impacted them personally and their families or their communities.
What was your sense about the kind of reception they were getting upon their entry into the United States, and what living conditions really were they subjected to in the detention center?
Well, those who had been detained in Mexico previously told us that it wasn't as bad as the jails in Mexico, so that's something. But they were really traumatized by the reception they got when they crossed the border, and they were put in border patrol stations first. They refer to these rooms as freezers. People who had sweaters, their sweaters were taken from them. Women who had asthma medication for their children, that was taken from them as well. And they were really scared. They didn't know what was going on, and they didn't know what would become of them.
Was there anyone there to, I don't know, comfort these children or offer them any sort of pastoral care?
Not at the Border Patrol facility. After they were transferred to the Artesia facility, there is one chaplain serving at Artesia. However, he said that he wasn't trained to care for families. He was usually placed in all-male detention facilities, so this was a completely new experience for him. And it gets worse when you're talking about mental health care. Most of these people are traumatized, and even the chaplain noted that there were children who he was afraid were suicidal. However, there was one psychologist available, and this was remotely. And so it's a woman who would Skype in from Washington, D.C., and there was one woman for all 600 people in the facility. And then there was one man who was supposed to provide psychological services for all the adult women. I think he was at Chrome in Miami, Florida.
And my understanding is not only are these children fleeing violence in their own countries, but are often subjected to violence and abuse on the trip north.
That's true. Those who can afford it hire coyotes who help them in their travel. However, they're known to extort more money out of people. Women have reported being raped on the journey by the coyotes, so it's not much safer traveling with somebody than trying to do it by themselves.
I understand, Sherita, that unlike others who may try to cross into the United States and who are trying to flee and disappear, these children, generally speaking, actually walk right up to border officials and ask for help. And so what resources are available to those children and sometimes their mothers as they try to navigate the difficult process of asking for either refugee status or asylum?
Unfortunately, there's not nearly enough resources available. The kids who are coming by themselves are transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement after a maximum of 72 hours with Border Patrol, and the Office of Refugee Resettlement either puts them with family members in the U.S. and cares for them while their cases are pending. They don't really have access to counsel in every case. There's groups that are trying to provide services, but there's just not enough. For the women and children who are coming, they're going through a different procedure. So they are either released, placed into alternatives to detention, usually supervised by local religious organizations. I know Catholic Charities runs a shelter in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Or what's suddenly popping up is they're being jailed. So Artesia is the second family detention center in the country. The first is in Berks, but that was only a short-term one. Before this, there was a facility in Taylor, Texas called Hutto that was shut down after lawsuits about severe inhumane conditions that women and children were being placed under.
You told me a story about a couple of women who came down, I believe it was from Colorado, to assist legally. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I had the privilege of meeting two women that drove down from Colorado. One is actually Christina Fithless, the chair of the American Bar Association Commission on Immigration, and the other is just a local attorney in Boulder. So she drove 9 hours down with a name and an alien registration number and got access to the woman and was able to get her released and joined to her husband's case. However, she said that the facility and the people in charge are making it increasingly more difficult for her to do her job and access clients. One of her clients was even deported without her even having a chance to interview the client. Another was interviewed without her present when she was at the facility. They just didn't call her into the room.
And often these deportations take place in the middle of the night?
Yes, there was a flight that left for Guatemala at 1 in the morning the day that we toured the facility, and nearly a third of the women and children on that plane were removed by the Guatemalan consulate because they'd expressed fear. Up until that point, they'd never had the opportunity to say that they were afraid of return.
And so they don't get asked about that because that would trigger an investigation or at least a hearing.
Exactly. The people at Artesia said that it's not their job to ask, that Border Patrol is supposed to ask, and so they never do the initial fear screening.
So it's a bit of a catch-22 for these children.
Yeah, if they don't know enough to say to someone in charge that they're afraid, they're not going to be asked at Artesia.
Wow. What do you think is needed in order for America to respond with compassion to these children?
We definitely need to be providing legal counsel to these kids. They've done countless studies showing that when lawyers are provided, they have better outcomes. Children are more than four times as likely to win their cases if they have a lawyer than without one. And it also makes the proceedings go faster. The city of New York is experimenting with a new program of providing free counsel to indigent immigrants and found that it moves cases along quicker and saves the city money. We also need more lawyers, more judges processing the cases, and more asylum officers processing these cases. And we need to stop jailing families. It's further traumatizing these families that have already gone through so much. And there's alternatives to detention in place that work really well and are far less costly than jailing families.
One chance to speak to the president and the Congress. Ask Congress to do what in your best estimate?
It's a humanitarian crisis, and they need to treat these families and children as people in need, not people to dispense with as quickly as possible for short-term political gains. We're having people fleeing horrific violence and coming to us for protection. And all I keep thinking about is during World War II, what happened with the St. Louis ship when we turned away Jewish people looking to us for protection from the horrors that they were facing in Germany. And I just strongly urge Congress not to let that happen again and to follow the current U.S. laws as they are written in regards to how we should treat people fleeing violence and fleeing persecution.
Sherita Gruberg has just returned from visiting the Artesia Detention Center in New Mexico, where some of the Central American child migrants are currently being held. Sherita is an attorney and a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. She previously worked at the Women's Refugee Commission. Sherita, I really appreciate you taking the time to brief us here on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me and for talking about this important issue.
The Obama administration asked Congress for $3.7 billion to help deal with the surge in unaccompanied minors crossing our border. Part of the response has been the demand from conservatives to cut that to just a fraction, and worse, to gut the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, TVPRA, signed into law by President Bush in 2008 as part of the negotiations. For an explanation of why the Trafficking Victims Act is so important and how it became a political football, we turn to Malika Sada Sarr, who's the executive director of the organization Rights for Girls. Malika, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Malika, would you briefly explain what this Anti-Sex Trafficking Act is and why it's an important law?
Sure. So the Trafficking Victims Protection Act is the most important piece of anti-trafficking legislation that we have. And in 2008, it went through its third reauthorization. The recognition at that point was that we have children, not only adults, but more importantly, children who are being trafficked for sex and for labor purposes. And so in order to provide an opportunity for safety, for rescue, for asylum for these children who are trafficked for labor and sex, the response of a Republican administration and both Democrats and Republicans in Congress was that we ought to make sure that in the third reauthorization of TVPRA, we provide this opportunity for safe haven and for due process for children who are being subject to trafficking and exploitation. And that's why we see the language in this reauthorization in 2008, that children who are being brought to the border from non-contiguous countries are allowed these protections. Because the recognition was that, surely, if children are being brought from places like Honduras or Bosnia, they in some way must be subject to trafficking or through some other kind of violence that brings them to a place where most children can't get to on their own volition.
And when a child is identified in that way, what happens to them then? What kind of hearing do they get? Do they automatically get considered for asylum, or how does that work?
So what's important about how it works is that it's an individualized assessment, and the assessment is done not by Border Patrol. The assessment is done by the Office of Refugee and Resettlement. And so it's under our Department of Health and Human Services, right, as opposed to the Department of Homeland Security. And that's a very important distinction because it's the recognition that these children have been exposed to violence, to trauma, and it makes more sense not to have Border Patrol going through that type of assessment, but instead an individual from ORR. And so what we've seen as a result are children who are offered very thoughtful, trauma-informed assessments that take into account how one interacts with a child who might be subject to trafficking. I mean, we know just from the children who are trafficked in this country, right, that they don't easily disclose, that a child who's trafficked in Compton isn't going to tell a police officer or her social worker that she's necessarily being trafficked, that there is a thoughtful process around what that interview and assessment ought to be. Well, the same is true for children who are being trafficked from Honduras or from Bosnia or elsewhere, from Nigeria, that their experience is harrowing and that they're children. And so how they talk about being bought and sold for sex is difficult and is fraught with shame. And so any type of interview and assessment with a child put into that traumatic situation must be done in a manner that's thoughtful, informed, and sensitive.
So this really has a lot to do, doesn't it, with the shift from regarding these children at our borders as criminals to thinking of them as victims and treating them in a wholly different manner.
Absolutely. And this provision, again, was brought into reality because our Congress and our Republican administration, I mean, because of how President Bush understood the epidemic of child trafficking all over the world, he was very thoughtful and very deliberate about making sure that we were a shining example of how trafficked children were to be treated.
How then did this very reasonable law come to be blamed for making the situation with Central American immigrants worse?
You know, I have to admit, I don't understand it. I mean, again, this was a provision that was passed in 2008, and we only see this crisis playing out of all these children coming to the border from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador really in the last 18 months. And so it doesn't really make sense to blame these child protections from 2008 on the recent surge of children coming across the border. It's a more difficult conversation and makes more sense to blame this on the violence that is playing out in these countries as opposed to a shining example of child rights and child protection that President Bush put forward.
Who then would be most at risk if this law is undone?
So our fear is that we will do a summary deportation of children who have been trafficked and exploited because the thoughtful protections that we have from 2008 will be stripped away. And so the anti-trafficking community, of which I am part of, has been very clear about saying if we strip out these provisions from TVPRA, we are at risk of returning these children who might have been exploited and trafficked. We will return them not only perhaps to their traffickers and exploiters or worse, because we know that when we are dealing with such violent countries and returning children to such violent situations, that we are putting them at great, great risk.
Yes, I believe the statistics show that Honduras is now the most dangerous country on earth, and the chances of getting killed there are five times what they were at the height of the Iraq war.
Indeed.
In Iraq.
Indeed.
So we would be returning these children to at least that kind of dangerous atmosphere, if not even to the traffickers themselves.
Which is why it makes no sense when both individuals from the Democratic and Republican sides of the aisle say that we don't want these children to come here because they are putting themselves at risk. But we put them at greater risk by returning them to these countries. And another piece that's important to surface here is that in the last 16 months, 40% of the children who have come over here are girls. And I think we have to ask that difficult question of why do we see a disproportionate number of girls fleeing these countries? Surely there's a connection between that stat and the issue of sexual violence. And we know that when we have war-torn countries, whether it's the Congo or Rwanda or Guatemala, that the way violence plays out against children and adults who are females is often in a sexualized manner, right? So the way that rape becomes an instrument of war, a weapon of war. If so many girls are coming over and escaping Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, there is this connection that must be discussed around how they are so vulnerable to sexual violence. And I have not heard that in the way that we've talked about who these children are, that too many of them are girls. And it is unacceptable that we should turn our backs to girls who are being disproportionately impacted by rape and sexual assault as a result of the wars in their countries.
So how do you think this 2008 reauthorization, how did it become such a bargaining chip? And why was that the focal point of the ask by conservatives in Congress in order to approve these additional funds for the border?
So I think it's important to recognize that it also came from the White House, right? So in the beginning, the White House wanted to seek discretion to be able to overturn the 2008 protections as well. Yes, this is the Republicans, but blame ought to be shouldered on the part of the White House as well. I think we needed something to hold responsible as opposed to having that difficult conversation around violence in Central America. And so it is easier to look at 2008 and these additional protections that were forged. It's much easier to scapegoat those added child-based protections than to have the very difficult conversation about the issues of war in Central America and how the remarkable violence that is playing out in these countries is also connected to the drug wars and the drug cartels and our own complicity in that.
What would a well-functioning immigration system look like when it comes to protections for unaccompanied children, regardless of their individual circumstances?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, because before this crisis, there was the conversation of how what is being provided to children from non-contiguous countries should also be provided to the children from Mexico. And part of that came out of a lot of research on the part of human rights organizations around issues of safety and well-being of children and the dangers of prolonged detention, that when children are put in situations of prolonged detention, how absolutely inimical that is on their well-being and their overall trajectories. So really good work was done around the argument against prolonged detention, which is what so many of the Mexican children have been subject to, and real contemplation of how can we take what is child protection law and extend it to all children.
Malika Sadasar is the executive director of the organization Rights for Girls, a project focused on the human rights of young women and girls in the United States. Malika, your insights have been very helpful in trying to make sense of this situation, and I want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
As the nation struggles with the humanitarian crisis at our border, there are plenty of politicians and talking heads doing their best to make hay of the situation. But how is all of this affecting everyday Americans across the country? The Public Religion Research Institute has just completed its July Religion and Tracking Survey and asked important questions about this urgent situation. Joining me now to talk about the key findings is Dr. Robert P. Jones, founding CEO of PRRI. Robbie, thanks for being here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
It looks like the key takeaway might be that Americans of all political persuasions are able to see the unaccompanied minors as refugees, despite the inflammatory rhetoric we've been hearing from the far right. What are those numbers?
Yeah. Well, you know, the key number here in the survey is 7 in 10. We had a number of questions that came out in that direction. The key ones are this. 7 in 10 Americans say that the children arriving from Central America should be treated as refugees and be allowed to stay in the U.S.
Not as criminals.
Not as illegal immigrants, right?
Right.
And so that makes a huge difference whether they're seen as refugees or illegal immigrants. 7 in 10 Americans say they should be seen as refugees. And when we ask about what the U.S. should do, also 7 in 10 say the U.S. should offer shelter and support to children while beginning a process to determine whether they're eligible to stay or not. Only about a quarter of Americans say they should be immediately deported without any due process. We had, you know, not only majorities of Democrats and independents agreeing, you know, that these children should be treated as refugees and given a legal hearing, but we also had a majority of Republicans. 57% of Republicans in the survey say they also say the best response should be offering shelter and support while beginning a process of legal determination.
And the feelings of those 7 in 10 Americans might be different just on the general topic of immigration, but when it regards children, there does seem to be this consensus.
Yeah, we actually have been asking both. So we've been asking about how the U.S. should respond to immigrants living in the country illegally in general. And even there, 58% of the country says that they should be allowed to have a path to citizenship, provided they meet certain requirements. So support here is about 12 points higher for the handling the unaccompanied children and providing a path for them to have a legal hearing to determine whether they're eligible to stay as refugees or not, as compared to a path to citizenship. But in both cases, we have, you know, 6 in 10 supporting a path to citizenship for immigrants in the country in general who are here without permission. But with the unaccompanied children, that number rises to 7 in 10.
Is religious background a predictor of the way a respondent might view this issue?
There are some significant religious differences that do track partisan differences here. So all on the way, we have found that white evangelical Protestants tend to be the least supportive of a path to citizenship. And they are, again, here on the situation of unaccompanied children, also the least supportive. Now, having said that, their numbers are right in line with where Republicans are as a whole, which is maybe not surprising since about 8 in 10 of them vote Republican. But 56% of white evangelical Protestants also say that they think the best response the government should have is to offer these children shelter and support while their cases are being decided. And in fact, there's not a single major religious group in the country that disagrees with that.
And what about a racial breakdown? I would guess that Hispanic Americans would be more in favor of treating these young people as refugees, but I'm not sure.
That's correct. But, you know, interestingly enough, minorities as a whole are more positive on this issue than whites are. So minority Protestants, for example, that includes African-American Protestants and Latino Protestants, 74% say that we should offer shelter and support.
7 in 10.
Yeah, so a little better than 7 in 10 and, you know, about 20 points higher than white evangelical Protestants on the question. But it's not just Hispanics. I mean, that's a kind of an important thing here that I think sometimes people think that African-Americans are in a much different place, and they're actually quite supportive on this issue.
What have you seen in terms of movement on this issue? As you look back at former tracking polls, what is the trajectory of American opinions about this issue?
That's a great question. It's really interesting. It's complex. On the one hand, we've been asking questions about American attitudes toward immigrants in general and their attitudes about how immigrants in the country should be dealt with, so that should they be offered a path to citizenship or not. And what we found is that since April, we've been in the field every week, we've been interviewing 1,000 Americans a week since April, and what we've seen is really over the past few weeks, as this issue about the southern border and the children from Central America is becoming more salient in the news, it has had some effect on people's concerns about the impact of immigrants. So we've seen on our basic question that says, do you believe immigrants are a burden because they take our jobs, housing, and health care, or do you think immigrants strengthen American society because of their hard work and talents? What we've seen is the numbers of Americans saying that immigrants are a burden have ticked up about 7 points in the last month. It was 35% who agreed with that statement in early July, and that number has come up to 42% today. Clearly, it has raised some concerns. It's also important to say that across that same time, we've seen absolutely no movement in the policy question, right? So in early July, 58% of the country said they preferred a path to citizenship for immigrants in the country illegally. That number is 58% today. It hasn't moved at all. So the concerns have come up, but it hasn't changed Americans' minds about how the U.S. should respond.
So they may be perceiving that there is a greater cost to this, financial and otherwise, but still there ought to be that pathway to citizenship.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Americans are really realist and pragmatists on this issue. You know, so I would say the big picture we see from the poll is that Americans are responding less out of ideology and more out of a kind of compassionate pragmatism. We have our sort of leaders who are staking out these kind of, you know, polarized ideological positions, and that's really not where the public is on the issue.
Do you ask questions about how the public is regarding Congress's actions, or I should say inactions, about this issue? What does the American public want Congress to do?
Yeah. Well, clearly they want a solution. I mean, I think that is the one thing that we see both in our polling and other polling. And I think the broad breadth of polling on Congress is looking at that right now Republicans are in a little worse shape than Democrats, but neither one of them are in good shape. So about a quarter of Americans think that Republicans are doing a good job. Only about a third of Americans think that Democrats are doing a good job. So, you know, sort of a pox on both of their houses, but a little more on the Republican side.
Right. So finally, I know your job is to find out what Americans are feeling about a particular situation at a point in time and not to predict the future. But all that aside, can you speculate on how these views might be trending upwards or downwards with respect to our more compassionate response to these vulnerable children?
You've used the word no pollster wants to hear, and that is speculate. let me go ahead and just say a little bit. You know, one thing that we'll be watching very closely is to see whether these concerns, if they continue to tick up, and the longer we don't have, you know, any solution that Americans can sort of wrap their heads around, I think the more these concerns are going to tick up. If that continues, you know, we'll have to see whether it has an effect on the policy question. But you know, right now, the picture we're seeing is that even though Americans are frustrated that there's no action, they are concerned. I mean, this is, you know, it's an historic number of people that we're seeing on the border. They are concerned. That's a serious issue. One aside, though, is that most Americans actually don't see this as a crisis. So we asked a question about whether people saw it as a crisis versus a serious problem versus a minor problem. And most Americans, a plurality of Americans, actually see the situation as a major problem but not a crisis. Only about a third of Americans say that it's a crisis. So I think Americans aren't quite at the boiling point yet on the issue, but I think the longer this goes without any serious action, the more troubling it will be to the public.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is CEO at the Public Religion Research Institute. You can read the July Religion and Tracking Poll, which is full of insights about American views toward the crisis at our – crisis, well, our major problem at our southern border at publicreligion.org. Robbie, this is a very timely piece of work, and I really appreciate your being here to shed some light on your findings for State of Belief listeners. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Always happy to be here.
Before we go, I just want to say that I always enjoy being asked to appear as Welton Gaddy's guest on this show. The subjects he covers are important ones, and the unique perspective he brings is an essential contribution to our nation's dialogue about what we believe, what we value, and who we want to be. It's been an honor to fill in for Welton as host this week, and I'm especially grateful to have had the chance to explore an issue that is so very important to me personally in this medium, and with some truly extraordinary guests. Welton will be back next week, and now I'll let State of Belief producer Ray Kirstein wrap things up. Thank you so much for listening.
The Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, the church's first openly gay priest to be elected and consecrated a bishop. A hero to millions, Bishop Gene is a lifelong champion for faithful inclusivity both within and beyond the church. He's the author of several books, including God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, and In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. Bishop Gene serves as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. You can follow his compelling writing online at The Daily Beast, The Huffington Post, and elsewhere, and we are very grateful for his agreeing to guest host State of Belief this week. Well, that is all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make the show possible, so please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country saying that they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter, and the listener line is 202-681-4246. We really do encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen also. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics, only here on State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.